Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Thank you to the awesome Jenny Green. Cork is the only spot for you, Jenny, on a staycation. Make sure to bring the decks. It's Wednesday, the 10th of June, and this is Game On.
Coming up today, our legend is the newest Harlequin, Gerry Flannery.
Fury versus Joshua, it's on, apparently.
Meghan Campbell discusses her new contract at Manchester City.
Brilliant news. And Mark Langdon joins us with all the latest on European football.
Game on 2FM.
All that and much more between now and 7 o'clock. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Here we go. Are we having that? Anthony Joshua versus Tyson Fury. They've agreed a two-fight deal, according to promoter Eddie Hearn.
Well, they've agreed the financial terms, which I'd imagine is probably the biggest thing that they need to overcome.
No, they just go in his back garden and scrap, is it?
Once the money is sorted, look...
Even agreeing two fights, Marie. Do you smell a rat there? One all. Oh, we need a third. No.
Well, yeah, that probably will happen, to be fair.
What else is going on around the place? I noticed we were chatting about it last night with Ruby, but today news, Roger Federer is to miss the rest of the season after undergoing knee surgery. There is now. I smell a rat there.
You want to see proof?
Yeah. We had a few of his teammates in of the importance of having the kind of marquee players at events. And all of a sudden, Roger's gone. Do you know what?
Conveniently injures his knee. Did you ever do that? Did you ever have a convenient injury?
No, I wasn't good enough to be out injured. Honestly, I promise you, there was an X man up. The amount of competition for places, I'd be run out the door.
I suppose when it's an individual sport, it's a little bit different.
You've every chance, all right, don't you?
There's nobody coming up behind you to take your spot. We spoke about the Olympics with David Giddick last week, the fact that they weren't going to be as extravagant as expected and potentially that some of the sports might not get to feature. And Giddick predicted that they were just starting to sow the seeds to let people know that there might be changes. And today, the CEO of Tokyo 2020 said that they will not be done with grand splendour. It's going to be simplified Olympic Games. I know we spoke about what sports we would throw out. I mean... We were just being hypothetical. We want all the sports involved. But I'd say that when it does come round, they've been hemorrhaging money for the last while with all their expenses, that we might not see the grandeur that we usually see at the Olympic Games, because they'll be paying a lot of bills between now and then.
But what are we talking? Like, what happens when you simplify in the Olympics? Do you remove a hurdle at the in the 100-metre hurdles? They now go over 9. You know what I mean? It's just so
they only let their certain amount of people into the opening ceremony, I'd say, would be one.
Okay.
The food might not be as nice in the canteen.
Bring your own.
Yeah. What else could they do?
Yeah, 51552. How can you simplify an Olympics? I think you could get rid of some of the silly sports, though, aren't they? Like, I'm all for the gymnastics, but the one with the ball, I don't get
beach
the
volleyball. Is it?
No, the beach volleyball is a staple and needs to be left.
How did I know you'd say that?
I think I'm speaking on behalf of the nation. What about, look, I know we were chatting golf last night with Gary Murphy, but we didn't know that US Ryder Cup captain has come out and said that he's going to make 6 selections himself. So Steve Stricker is going to decide on, the PGA Tour. Some will get there, 6 will get there on points, and then he'll select 6.
You sound like you've an issue with this.
I'd be cozying up to him straight away. I'd be like, all right, Strix, how we doing? How we fixed?
Yeah, him to a WhatsApp group.
But I'm interested on with Padraig Harrington and how he'll go with something like that, because, you know, there's a few of the Irish lads. Surely he'd go all Irish if he'd 6 selections.
I'd say with Harrington and the competitor that he is, I don't know how loyal he'd be. I think it'd just be about winning.
No, but you be loyal to the Irish lads, like, because they'll pay it back. They'll want him to go well. So just surround yourself with.
Well, I think if they're merited to get there at the time, then fair enough. But I don't think there'll be any sympathy calls from Harrington.
No,
somehow.
Forget the merit. Shane Lowry on the plane. Put him on the plane. Make it green.
Doesn't matter if you deserve to be there or not.
No,
that's the last
thing. Yeah, Irish only. Good news, Chelsea.
Go
Chelsea,
on.
Yeah, we'll be Chelsea, we'll be chatting to Megan Campbell shortly, but Chelsea have donated all the prize money from winning the Super League. So their women's team won the Super League, and they're giving the prize money that they won, 100,000, to the UK charities, which is an incredible gesture, isn't it?
Absolutely, it really is. I wonder, they obviously are been well looked after by their club.
Yeah.
They can do that.
I know what you're saying, because there's other teams in that league that are really struggling.
Exactly, Donegal, yeah.
Yeah.
But Chelsea are one of the ones who have been looked after very well. We've had Lisa Fallon on, who was a coach there, and she has told us in a lot of detail about the facilities, the access, even the gear they get. They're just so well looked after. So, yeah.
And rightly so. That's the level it should be at throughout it, isn't it?
Unlike Liverpool, who don't look after the women's team well at all.
Well,
they're relegated, and we mentioned it in passing before, but they've had a lot of difficulty. They're not well integrated with the club. They have to play in Tranmere, so they don't have access to their new training ground, and a lot of the players came out after they were relegated and just expressed disappointment with the setup, and people have called for Liverpool to be better, and I hope that they will be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Marie, yesterday Harlequins announced the signing of Gerry Flannery. The Munster and Ireland Grand Slam winner will feel right at home in a star-studded dressing room full of players and coaches with terrible haircuts, but with a massive thirst to succeed and a hunger to improve. We're delighted the new Harlequins coach joins us now. Gerry, how are you?
An unnecessary dig to start the interview, Donegal.
Great news, Gerry. If you like, I know, like, personally, I know there would have been an awful lot of offers to get you back in the game. Why Harlequins?
Well, I have to look at it from my point of view. It's difficult, like, when you're leaving a club like Munster, about planning what your next step is going to be, because, you know, there's very few clubs on the same stature as Munster. But what I looked at it is a few factors. The fact that they have, like, they've the likes of Alex Dambrand coming through, or Marcus Smith. They've got real good young players coming through. They've added in a good blend of experience then with the likes of Ashton, Mike Brown, Danny Kerr, Marler. And then in their coaching staff, they have, obviously, you know, Paul Gustard has got a huge reputation. He's very, very passionate about coaching. And I think that there's good scope for me to develop there as a coach myself. And I think that, you know, they would have been always a club that would have been probably to the forefront of my mind when I was growing up as a kid. I suppose Keith Wood playing with them and stuff like that. And I think they're a real sleeping giant. I think if you look at the way, you know, Saracens have turned their club around. Now, obviously, things have gone haywire a little bit for them now recently, but they have a you look at certain things like a real strong supporter base, a real strong rugby tradition, and they have all those things. All those factors kind of came in, and I was excited about going over there. And it's From my partner's point of view, Katie, like, that's, she's from Guildford as well, so there's straight away we can settle in, her family will be around, so it allows me to focus 100% in the job rather than, you know, being concerned whether she's settling in, you know, when we get over. So a lot of little things like that.
Gerry, I just know from being a sports fan, like, I love when I see former sports stars going on to coaching and following their careers and see how they get on. What's the landscape like for rugby coaches? Like, is there many opportunities there? Like, how hard is it to make it?
I would say it's difficult to break into. I think I was just very, very fortunate. Anthony Foley gave me a shot, and I don't think it's because I showed any real potential as a coach or anything when I was in my playing career, but I did take time to study coaching when I retired. I think it is difficult, but I think the RFU are definitely trying to really, you know, cement a pathway there for Indigenous Irish coaches to come through. And, you know, you look at the likes of Nigel Carolyn, who's come through the academy setup, and now is the attack coach up in Connacht. Jimmy Duffy is the forwards coach there. Obviously, in Leinster, you've got Leo Cullen there, and Hugh Hogan has come up. Gervin Dempsey has moved on from there, and he's gone over to Bath. Felix Jones won a World Cup medal with South Africa. Dan McFarland is up there, up in Ulster, and they would have brought Jared Payne in and you know, incorporated him into the coaching setup. So, I suppose the reality is, Marie, there's only four teams here, four professional teams for you to be involved with. So for a lot of people, they have to make the choice that if they've been one of those teams, their next move then probably much has to be abroad. But I think the union do a good job in sort of maintaining connections with foreign coaches when they go away. I know that, you know, the IRFU have been on to me already with coaching support, saying, listen, we're just because you're working in Ireland, we'll still provide coaching support. And Matt Wilkie has reached out to me, and he's been a huge support to me. So it is a difficult path to get into, but I think if you're determined enough, you'll get there. It's just how long you're willing to stick at it.
Tunick and I have had the conversation in the past about whether or not, when you've played for a province, you would move to a different province. Does that come into play when you're coaching as well? Like, if you could you see yourself coaching another province here in Ireland?
I don't know, to be honest. It's a very difficult one. I start to see, I think, because if I'm really honest, like I was always a Munster player. I came back, I was coaching Munster. I saw it as everything was just Munster. And now I realise that you have to move around. You have to see different, you know, work with different coaches, learn off different people, see different environments. And then you can ultimately come back and, you know, if Munster is where you want to go, or if you have an ambition, you want to ultimately be the best coach you can be. If you only stay in one place, you'll only learn one thing. Now, I suppose the reality is that coaches turn over, so you can get to work under different coaches. But, you know, if you've been really, really successful, then the coach, you know, there's not going to be an awful lot of change there. So I think generally if you want to be the best coach, you have to be willing to travel. You have to be able to work under different kind of rugby programs and see how players respond in different environments, and then you can formulate your own plans as to what you think would suit you best then as a coach.
Gerry, you mentioned it there, only learning one thing from kind of looking in, but we've seen it with the likes of Dennis Lemino and Leinster. You mentioned Rog, Ron O'Gara, Felix Jones. If you look at it, Mike Prendergast, Jason Holland, myself winning Ireland's Fittest Family. There's something that goes on with the Munster lads that makes them transferable to other environments to go on well and do well in coaching.
Again, nice plug for yourself there, Dunners. I think a lot of it is I think both of us in particular, like people like, even I suppose people like Ronan and O'Gara, like a lot of the best players that you see, sometimes they're
you're on the road, not, man.
It's just I'm over by a car here and I'm going to move away from it now.
That'd be good. We are on the national broadcaster there.
A lot of the very best players, a lot of it is instinctive for them, you know. But for a lot of the lads who actually have to really learn how to, you know, they have to fail and they have to go back and revisit their technique, they become good coaches from that. And I think by virtue of me not having a huge amount of natural ability, but I was quite determined that I would always be trying to learn. And I think Rog is actually similar. I know it's weird for a guy who has, you know, over 120 caps or something like that to say that, but I think, you know, Leamy then on the other side, Leamy would be a far more natural player and probably had to work on the coaching process of how he articulates across. He was just such an amazing player, but has a very, you know, was always a very good deep thinker on the game. I think coaching comes down to your ability to articulate, you know, the techniques and to build relationships with players and make it easy for them to learn, you know. Just because you understand this yourself doesn't mean that the other players understand until you actually can really get the message across to them.
Again, Flo, will you get off the road? Just before you get run over, just the Harlequin style of play, it's brilliant to watch. They'll run it from everywhere, but it isn't maybe what you've grown up around or that what you've coached. How are you going to have to evolve to buy in with the philosophy of the way they play?
I think for sure Harlequins, like, attacking rugby is in their DNA. And you never want to, you know, when you go to a new club, you want to embrace that. And I think that, I suppose, if you look at Paul Gustard has gone in there, he was the defence coach with Saracens and he got that Wolfpack mentality. Then he was the defence coach with England. And now he's gone into a club that's known for flamboyant rugby and flair. And I think he's looking to embrace that, but add to it. You know, like, it's, it's fine saying that, listen, we just love to play ball and we love to throw it around in a new way and it's just play the game. But, you know, it'll come down to November, December, January when the weather is rubbish and, you know, you've got to have a strong kicking game, you've got to have a strong set piece, a strong defence. And then after that, then it's when if you can get through those points in the season, then when it comes to the end, when the pitches are hard or the ball is dry, you can allow players to express themselves as well. But there's kind of fundamentals that have to go with it, but you embrace what the team's real strength is, because that's what supporters, you know, that's what they're that's what they come to expect from the team, you know. And if they don't see it, they probably are you know, I suppose like Munster supporters probably would have been a little bit put off when they saw you on the wing and they're like, why isn't Donegal carrying the ball in the middle of the field? But you know, there has to be a you know, an evolution as well in the way teams play. But I think embracing what is at the core of that club's DNA is important as well.
You mentioned some of the coaches, your own brilliant coaches like Axel, Razzie, but you've also been around good environments. Your stint in Arsenal, what will you take from that, Jerry? What have you seen from other sports that you can bring to your coaching?
Look, I think there's the obviously, look, football and rugby completely different, but you're still dealing with humans, you're still dealing with players, and your ability to connect with a player and to build an informal relationship, and for that player to get, I suppose, to see that you'll treat him consistently and to give him clarity around what your expectations are from him, and then he knows that, listen, if I do A, B, then, you know, that would be good enough. That's what the coaches expect of me. And I think you build trust with the players, and then that's how you develop them, really, you know. Because, you know, technically, the things that I did in Arsenal versus the things that I look to do in rugby are quite different. But you still have to get the players on side. You still have to create a high performance environment where people are looking to be excellent in everything that they're trying to do.
Yeah. You mentioned that Harlequins, obviously a massive traditional club, like you were saying, looking on when Keith Wood was there. But they've gone a long time now, Fla, since success. You know, like winning the Aviva in 2012, you're kind of going straight into a pressure environment, aren't you?
Yeah, well, it's going to be pressure, I suppose, pretty much anywhere you go. You don't really want to go somewhere where people don't expect to win, you know. There's similarities there in terms of, you know, I suppose what like from Munster's point of view, that, you know, their last Magners League was, you know, nearly 10 years ago, and I suppose the same thing for Quinns in terms of their last Premiership title was nearly 10 years ago now. So, you know, you want to go in somewhere where people have an expectation to win, because it brings a kind of a positive pressure, you know. It means that if you think that people will just accept losing or accept mediocrity, then that's where your standards will get to eventually. But I'm looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to getting over and getting stuck in and just getting back in the game again.
Will you miss Munster, Jerry?
Very much so, yeah. Maria, I love the club, and it's afforded me, you know, unbelievable opportunities in my life in terms of getting to play with Munster, getting to play with so many fantastic players like Donner's there and all the lads.
Well, I thought you weren't going to put him in that.
Oh, well, listen, he's been pumping his own tyres now since the start of the show. But it's given me so much, the club. And then, you know, for Axel to give me a break in coaching, to bring me in, and I learnt an awful lot there. And working under Axel, under Rassi, under Johan, like, I've learnt an awful lot as a coach. And I feel like my best days are definitely ahead of me as a coach. So I would have loved to have won something with Munster. I felt like to repay the province for everything it had done for me, but it wasn't to be. But like I certainly don't feel like I could have given any more when I was there. I will miss Munster a lot, but sure, I think that they've recruited very strongly, and I think that they're going to be in the mix now. I think there's a very good chance of getting some silverware in the near distant future.
Well, I know myself, like all Munster supporters, at hope it's a pause as opposed to a full stop. I know already there's massive Munster supporters looking to book to get to the Harlequins versus London Irish game to obviously watch yourself, Declan Kidney, Les Kiss. So there is big Irish interest over there. Jerry, best of luck with it. We'll be shouting an horn for you. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks, lads.
Yeah, we're doing that usual thing where the ads won't play. So can we bring
Jerry
back again?
Where was Jerry Flannery? If someone's out on the road and nearly ran over Jerry Flannery, could you text us in and tell us what he was doing? Because as much as I love him, he could be walking down the main street in Limerick or down one of the motorways. He's a beauty. No, he's gone off the phone, of course.
People are probably seeing him and knowing him and beeping and waving.
Yeah, about a kid.
That's what happens when you're a big movie star and also a fittest family star.
So yeah, the
you
old lads.
Well.
Should I start plugging Centre here? Is that where you need to go?
Nearly have it fixed. He'd be a good coach, though, Donica, on a serious note.
He will be a good coach. He'd be great, Marie. And like I remember we had a fight. We had a massive fight in one of our goal setting things at the start of a season because Jerry wanted us to go unbeaten for the year, and all of us are driven and wanted to go really well, but it just. That seemed like an impossible task. And you didn't want to be negative, but we were going off to World Cup. You were going to make it so hard on younger players to, you know, to attain a 100% record throughout a big season. And I remember he was so odd. He was so upset. I remember he wouldn't kind of chat to me for two hours after it. He was there, why don't you see what we can do here, man? And I'll be honest, himself, kind of Barry Murphy, Trevor Hogan, Ian Dowling, they were vital to those wins because they came in with a new attitude around Munster. All of us were there with this kind of chip on our shoulder, whereas they came in with the chest out going, we're class. And we hadn't heard this before. We were like, who is this beaut? But they fully believe it.
Game on 2FM.
So welcome back. Now, amidst all the chaos and uncertainty at the moment, there was good news for Republic of Ireland international Megan Campbell, who has secured a new one-year contract with Manchester City. She joins us now on the line. Megan, great news. Congratulations. It must be super to have that security in such an uncertain time.
Hiya, thanks for having me. I'm obviously delighted that, you know, I can get that security behind me from Manchester City. And it's nice for me to be able to now focus on my rehab to get me back onto the pitch rather than focusing on maybe where I would be playing next. So I'm very grateful for that, and hopefully I can get back on the grass and, you know, repay them.
It's been a tough time for you, Megan, and unfortunately you are, as I'm sure you're well aware, very susceptible to injuries. So you've had to come back from a few. Will you tell us about the latest one?
Yeah, unfortunately I am, you know, stuck with a lot of injuries since joining Manchester City, and I don't think people have seen the best of me yet. But the latest injury that I've unfortunately picked up in January, just after the new year, I was looking forward to the fresh start of a new year, new me kind of thing. And unfortunately, in our first game against Tottenham Hotspur, I snapped a tendon in my right ankle, which obviously needed surgery in the end. It's quite a complicated injury. It doesn't really happen in footballers. Speaking with my surgeon in London, he's only ever dealt with two other cases in men's football. And there's a 50-50 chance, basically, of getting back to some level of playing. So, you know, for me, it could be career ending, but I'm not looking at it like that. I'm, you know, just going to keep my head down and keep working hard. And as each day comes, I'll hopefully be progressing and getting myself back on the pitch.
Megan, that must be the beauty of what Man City have done, though. No, with backing you, with rolling on a contract, knowing your potential and what you can do when you do get back out in the grass.
Yeah, I think, you know, towards the end of the 2017 season when we were in the spring series and then in the FA Cup final, in Wembley against Birmingham, you know, I think I showed glimpses of maybe what I was capable of doing for Manchester City. Aside from that, I don't really think that I was able to perform at my best because I was always either just coming back from an injury or trying to get myself fit to be able to compete. So, it's always been tough, but it's nice to have their faith in me. And with speaking to the general manager and the new manager, Gaz, like, you know, they're looking forward to me getting back on the grass, and they know my ability and they know what I bring to the team. So, yeah, I'm just really looking forward to it, and fingers crossed all goes well.
Well, if people haven't seen you playing for Manchester City, anyone that's seen you playing for the Republic of Ireland will certainly know what you offer, Megan. And I've been covering the team for a while now, and any time your name is on the team sheet, it just gives everybody a big boost.
Well, I'm humble that you say that. Thank you. For me, playing for a national team is obviously, you know, it's second to none. You couldn't really put it up against anything else. And it's an honour to play and wear the green jersey. And any time that I get to do so with such a great team and great group of girls is an honour. So, yeah, I've played with national team for quite some time now, obviously not as many probably games as I would have liked to due to the injuries as well, unfortunately. But, you know, hopefully with the current campaign finishing up the end of this season, I'll be back fit and raring to go to help the team in any way I can.
Megan, you mentioned that lockdown is hard enough without being injured. How have you managed that? You know, just staying positive. Normally injured players, it's good to be around the team. Just being isolated at the moment must have been tough.
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm very, like, you know, I'm very fortunate in the fact that Manchester City have access for me to get all the equipment that I need through Perform Better. They've sent me all the equipment that I will need in the early stages of my rehab. I'm on constant FaceTime and Zoom calls and team calls, every technology possible with my physio and S&C to stay on track. And thankfully, with speaking with my surgeon on Monday, he's really happy where I'm at and I'm not behind in any of my rehab. So I think I'm quite fortunate in that front. But I do think, like you said, it is hard some days than others, like to get out of the bed, to get myself motivated, because I don't have anyone physically there looking at me. It's all on me to get going. But yeah, I think some days is obviously better than others. Like I said, being around the team, it has its pros and cons. It's tough when you're watching them playing games of a weekend and you can't be involved, and seeing them going out and going onto the training pitch while you're stuck in the gym. So, you know, I am taking positives from it in that everyone's on a break now, and so I'm not really missing out. So, yeah, my aim is just to keep my head down, working hard and get myself back as fit as I can.
So when you're injured, Megan, can you practice those legendary long throws?
I don't think I've ever practiced them throwing.
Really?
I
was watching clips of you yesterday, like absolutely amazing. I spent a good portion of the day actually just on YouTube watching you. Did they talk me through it? Is that just something you've always had in your locker?
Yeah, I think so many people ask me this question, I never know what to say. You know, I really wish I had a cool answer. So, like, I used to get slagged saying, obviously because you're from Ireland, there's obviously loads of countryside and you probably lived on a farm and you were chucking hay barrels and all this rubbish. Like, you get bantered. But no, I've literally just had it. And since I was a kid, playing with boys, it was longer than the rest. And as I grew, it got longer. And yeah, it's obviously been a weapon for us national team wise, but sometimes with City as well. But a lot more of the time, it's quite technical and quick throw-ins and get counter-attacks going. So, but if it's called upon, I'll obviously use it.
And a lot of goals come from them as well.
Yeah, opponents say it's like defending the corner, but it's with even obviously faster pace because you can't judge where it's going to land and it's quite direct, whereas on corners they could be either floated or curled. So yeah, it's a nice asset to have in your team.
Megan, it's been brilliant though. I know there's been disappointing injuries, but a domestic treble in your first season, you know, it has been a great move for you.
Yeah, definitely. There's obviously been a lot of highlights. There is, looking in from the outset, people are going to probably, you know, pick up on the negatives more so than the positives, because unfortunately there have been more of them. But for me, I'm trying to cling to those positives. Like you said, playing in the FA Cup final in Wembley, having two assists, like probably playing one of the best games I did, getting to play in Champions League, winning domestic trophies, training and playing with, you know, some of the best players in the women's game in the world. And doing it with a Man City badge on my chest is like obviously an unbelievable achievement.
And Megan, we're seeing more and more girls now getting their chance to play in the UK. How important is it to have a strong representation from the Irish team playing in the Super League?
I think it's brilliant. Obviously, more and more of us are travelling over to, you know, professional environments, and I think that can really help us push on. And I think people will see it that we have improved as a national team a lot due to the fact that obviously the progressions within the FAI to help us, but also with players travelling abroad and being at that professional level, because it's different. Like training and playing every day with top players, it pushes you to a different level that you never thought you could get to. And then you obviously have players travelling to different countries in Europe as well. So, and even Denise in the United States. So yeah, it's brilliant.
I think, you know, when you don't watch it week in, week out or follow it, it's probably hard to understand how competitive it is. But we saw Louise Quinn, unfortunately, hasn't been retained at Arsenal. But then on a positive note, Niamh Fahey is staying with Liverpool for two more years, albeit they are being relegated. But still, it is hard to get a contract at that level, Megan.
Yeah, it's a very competitive league, but I've no doubt that that Louise and every other player who, you know, will come abroad will get contracts, because they're great individuals. They're both professional on and off the pitch. And in general, they're just great people. But it is competitive, like you said, and it's growing year on year. And it shows with the representation that we also have then in Champions League and how we put forward English teams from that league into that competition. But yeah, I'm just really fortunate that obviously I've still got, I'm still at a club that I am at, and I'm still pushing to play games.
And, you know, we're seeing it with, like, just names being unveiled. The calibre of players that the Super League is attracting is phenomenal, and it's increasing all the time.
Yeah, there's world-class players coming from everywhere that want to be involved in this league because, I mean, in my opinion, it is the best league in the world for women's football. I think it's the most competitive. Like, people will probably say that the German and French leagues are up there because they obviously always have the winners of the Champions League, but I think consecutively, in terms of every game you play, it's never an easy win. It's always a competitive battle. And it obviously pushes teams to improve and to match each other. So, yeah, I definitely think it's probably up there with one of the best, if not the best, in my opinion, in the world for women's football.
Megan, do you feel a pressure then? You know, like, you're living your dream there. All the Irish girls are looking over, seeing you make the jump. And, you know, just for the calibre of and standard you play at, for them to kind of go, yeah, these Irish girls, maybe there's more of them over there that could be playing professional sport.
I wouldn't really look at myself as maybe being a role model, even though, like you obviously have little girls that look up to you and young girls in the under-17s, 19s, and even in the senior setup. But, you know, I think we are a talented group in the national setup, and anyone who was to come to England would have no issues getting a contract. Because, like I said before, they're all good girls. They've got great personalities, and on the pitch, they're technically brilliant. So I think if people take the challenge on coming to England, I don't think that they will struggle with it. It's obviously of high calibre, like you said, and you've got high top-class players there. But it can only improve you as a player. And I think when I look at it that way, like, that's what I'm there to do. I'm there to constantly try and improve myself daily. And I can do that when I'm around the best.
And I think Donika will definitely agree with this, that anyone who's playing professional sport wants to test themselves at the top level. And next up for Ireland is Germany in September. And, like, that's going to come around pretty quick.
Yeah, it doesn't really come much bigger, does it?
No.
They've always been a fierce opponent of ours at international level. And you know, it's always been that towards the last few years, it's always been a more competitive battle. And so I'm really looking forward to that. Obviously, I'm thankful that they've been rescheduled for the end of this season. So I'll hopefully be fit and in contention. But yeah, like you said, the games are coming thick and fast now that everything's been pushed back a bit. So I think the focus has to be on everyone's individual programs right now to keep himself ticking over, keep himself fit, and when the season starts again to then stay fit and fresh and ready for the Germans.
We know that qualifying for a major tournament has been on the minds of all women's footballers in this country for a long time now. How close do you think you are, Megan?
I don't think we're far off at all, Marie. I think it's something that's been growing for quite a few years now, and I think we've seen a lot of improvements over the last number of years in every aspect. And, you know, the professional aspect from the girls as well, and how they look upon things is, you know, improved. And I think it's improved, but we're thankful because we've got everything that we need around us now. You know, everything is on our side, and we're really looking forward to obviously the challenge against the Germans. But the most important game for us as well in this group is Ukraine away. And, you know, it will be probably between us and them right now for second place. And then if we can take points from the Germans, it's brilliant. But I don't think we're far off at all, and fingers crossed we'll now be at 2022 Euros instead of 2021. But everyone's raring to go. We're ready, and we're more determined than ever to represent Ireland and to wear that green jersey at a major tournament.
Megan, I'm always interested with how much Vera Pauw is actually bought in. You can see how much it means to her already. Just for you, how much contact, even during injury, has she been in contact much with you?
Yeah, she was in contact with me right before surgery, right after surgery, and most recently as well. And then just today, I've just got off a call with her and all the English-based players just to go through what we're doing in the meantime, in between the season and pre-season starting. So, you know, she's had a big impact on the squad since she's come in, and she's, you know, trying to get everyone ready to go against the Germans, because obviously she knows what they're like, and they're a tough opponent. But in general, it's just that professional outlook that she has can help drive you forward. And with the experience that she has as well, it's obviously brilliant.
Well, Megan, we are looking forward to seeing you in the blue and green very, very soon. Thanks so much for joining us and best of luck with the future.
Thank you, Marie. Thank you, Donna.
Game on 2FM.
I'm just after getting off the phone with Daniel Kinahan. He's just informed me that the biggest fight in British boxing history has just been agreed. Big shout out, Dan. He got this done literally over the line. Two fight deal. Tyson Fury versus Anthony Joshua next year.
That was Tyson Fury speaking after the announcement today that he has agreed a two fight deal with Anthony Joshua. He mentioned Daniel Kinahan, who was brokering the deal. It's another chapter in the reinvention of Kinahan. To discuss this, we are joined by Gavin Casey of The 42. Gavin, you were on with us recently about Kinahan's presence in boxing, and this announcement today, it seems that it will have elevated that. What does it mean for Kinahan's status in boxing on the world stage?
Well, Marie, I think there are two ways of looking at the announcement. The first is that the name Daniel Kinahan will now be ringing around living rooms and offices and whatnot around the world, because people consuming this news via social media or what have you will be watching clips or seeing Instagram posts of Tyson Fury crediting Kinahan on more than one occasion of, as you say, brokering the fight. So in terms of what Kinahan has been trying to do with this sort of orchestrated PR campaign to legitimize himself in the eyes of the masses, probably predominantly outside of Ireland, it's another successful job, you could argue. On the face of it, in a purely boxing context, this is actually a bit of a nonsensical announcement. It really means very little. What they've announced is that Fury and Joshua have agreed to a two-fight deal on principle. Basically, they've agreed probably to a 50-50 split of a purse that is yet to be determined, with no broadcast deal on the table yet, no venue, no date, plus the fact that both of them have at least one fight each to get out of the way before they actually meet in the middle. So a lot can go wrong before they actually do meet in the ring. And it will be consumed and sort of repackaged by media outlets as being fight agreed and like the fight is on, but it's actually a long, long way from being on still. And I think that would probably raise the question as to why you make such a hullabaloo about it, about this announcement. It would probably strike me as something designed to get Kinahan's name out there as this prominent figure within the sport.
Well, it certainly did that, because we are talking about it as we were a few weeks ago when Bob Arum mentioned him as well and was full of praise for him. So it does seem that in this next chapter of, I suppose, legitimising himself, he's starting to get there.
Yeah, I think so. If you look at the way this news was, I suppose, broadcast around the world, like the BBC Sport Twitter account have posted this clip of Fury in which he thanks Kinahan. The BT Sport account have done the same. I think it was curious, actually, with the BBC's clip that they tweeted out. It's literally just a post by Tyson Fury on his own social platforms that they've kind of repackaged. But they caught out at the start of Fury's monologue the part in which he says, "I'm just off the phone with Daniel Kinahan," and they leave instead a couple of very vague allusions to somebody named Dan within the clip. And I think that raises questions in itself. But when you just consider the fact that BT Sport, an organization the size of that and so prevalent in Irish homes, UK homes, whatever, are kind of comfortable with this kind of credit being given to Daniel Kinahan, and how it just seems normal now. Like it has been normalized to an extent where I'm sure references to Kinahan will go over a lot of people's heads, because to be honest, anybody who is only a casual observer in boxing couldn't care less for the more peripheral figures involved within it. But it's just this, I think we're through the looking glass in a way, that he has, as you say, been this extremely relevant and prominent figure within the negotiations for this fight, which aren't over the line yet, but clearly he has played a role in the first step being brought over the line. Now, I'd say as well that, look, like the way Kinahan is being portrayed by fighters with whom he's associated, Fury being probably the most famous one, is that he's some sort of a genius, and this fight deal couldn't possibly get over the line without his intervention, without his help. Now, you have Frank Warren, who promotes Tyson Fury in the UK, has previously told Sky Sports that this is not a difficult fight to make. And really, look, if there's a genius in getting two of the biggest fighters in the world to agree to a 50-50 split, then maybe Daniel Kinahan is a genius. But I think it's more so, again, a kind of that an orchestrated attempt to make him seem incredibly important to the biggest fight of the last 30 years, whereas the reality is the fight, I'm sure, could have gotten over the line without his involvement.
So one of the biggest fights in the last 30 years, is that where you think this fight is?
Yeah, definitely. It is. It is. Look, if you look at the biggest fight of the last half century, even, it would have been Manny Pacquiao against Floyd Mayweather in 2015, worth upwards of $400 and something million, 4.4 million pay-per-view buys, something along those lines. And this is probably the next in line in terms of being certainly the biggest fight since then, and certainly the biggest heavyweight fight since the kind of Lennox Lewis, Mike Tyson, Evander Holyfield days in the early 90s to 2000. So it's a fight of enormous magnitude. Two British heavyweights as well, which adds a kind of a parochial element to it. But it's a kind of a fight that will transcend Britain. Like, there are the eyes on this from all over the world, particularly in America, where in the past Americans might have viewed the heavyweight division as being kind of worthless without an American champion, particularly when the Klitschko brothers were dominating. They didn't necessarily inspire much captivation among an American audience. But in Fury and Joshua, two guys who are a little bit more familiar to the US, having fought over there and kind of established their own respective fan bases over there now, this is just a legitimately massive fight. It's, look, there's a kind of a romanticism attached to the world heavyweight title, and whoever wins this prospective fight down the line is the world heavyweight champion. And I think there's always a kind of a mainstream curiosity in that as well, when there is going to be one guy crowned as the best of the big men in the sport of boxing.
And the next big question that remains to be answered is, where will this fight be on?
It's interesting, like, Eddie Hearn was speaking to IFL TV, a kind of a YouTube publication, I guess, or a channel in which they interview fighters and promoters and so on. It's sponsored by NTK Global. Hearn has never actually alluded to Kinahan in any of these interviews, even when he was tempted to do so in today's interview in relation to this fight being agreed in principle. He was asked, was there any turning point in the negotiations? And he kind of just said no. And he's been a little bit more maybe shrewd in terms of his own image in not directly alluding to Kinahan. But he said within that interview that the venue is literally completely open to all possibilities all around the world. One would suggest, given Kinahan's involvement and given some of the, not even whispers, but kind of shouts coming from that side of the negotiations, that the fight would wind up in the Middle East, where Kinahan is based, where Bob Arum, who promotes Fury in the States, has sort of declared Kinahan the captain of organization and logistical issues. You'd imagine as well, with the financial pull involved in a fight over there, when you consider certain governments, particularly Saudi Arabia, as we saw with the Joshua Rees rematch a couple of months ago, are keen to wash their image through sport and will put up money in order to be able to do that. You could imagine the fight landing on that side of the world, which would be a shame in one sense, because again, it's two great British heavyweight champions, and Wembley obviously would be the optimal location for. Now, you could conceivably see one of them happening in the Middle East to begin with, and then a rematch back in the UK, and the rematch maybe being sold as being more so for the fans, but at the same time, money talks, and if the rematch was to be bigger than the first one, then you're probably not going to turn down the extra $150 million or so to bring it back to the Middle East.
And in terms of a timeline, what comes next for Fury and Joshua?
Yeah, they both have fights in the interim penciled in. So Joshua is supposed to be defending his titles against a Bulgarian by the name of Kubrat Pulev. It should be a relatively straightforward fight for him, and that's been sort of earmarked for a while. It was scheduled to take place at Tottenham's new stadium before the advent of the coronavirus and so on, but that's still very much in the pipeline. It'll happen in the latter half of 2020, obviously, at this stage. And then Fury has a third fight earmarked with Deontay Wilder. It's kind of it remains to be seen really how ready Wilder is for that fight, but certainly Fury would seem to believe that that fight has kind of been agreed and will happen. Now, we saw obviously Fury really dismantled and destroyed Wilder in their original rematch only a few months back. So on the one hand, you could suggest that that should be relatively straightforward for him, and therefore two of them win their fights in the interim, and it sets up this massive showdown in 2021 between them. But you've got a sort of a man in the middle then, Dillian Whyte, who's promoted by Eddie Hearn, he's actually due to have a mandatory fight against Tyson Fury before February 2021. So that's another little issue for all of the stakeholders to overcome. You could potentially offer White some step-aside money so that he just kind of takes another fight and keeps himself busy and eventually fights the winner. But at the same time, White's not going to take that easily. He's been waiting an awfully long time for his own chance at the title. So they both will definitely have a fight before they face each other, if they do. And there could conceivably be more complications in the shape of White before that fight takes place in 2021. So I don't know that you could necessarily look at this as even taking place in the first half of 2021. It'll really depend on the rest of the negotiation.
Okay, Gavin, so still a long way to go in that, but an interesting announcement about the Fury-Joshua fight nonetheless. Gavin Casey of The 42, thanks so much for joining us.
Game on 2FM.
Okay, European soccer steps up tomorrow with the return of La Liga, and there is plenty at stake with the title race, European places and the battle to avoid relegation wide open. To talk us through it, we're delighted to be joined by Racing Post's Mark Langdon. Mark, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Are you okay?
We're good. We're obviously very giddy to have more sports back. Big one tomorrow with La Liga. And this is a proper race, isn't it? Barca, just 2 points over Real.
Yeah, absolutely. Going to be, I think, a really tight battle. I spoke to Luis Garcia, a former Liverpool player, today. He thinks that Barcelona are favourites because they kind of needed the break a little bit more than Real Madrid. And I think you can definitely make a case for that, because Luis Suarez was set to miss the rest of the season due to injury. But of course, the season was then stopped, and a massive player really for Barcelona to have back. We also don't know how Real Madrid are going to adjust to playing their home matches at their training ground, particularly as Spanish government are now suggesting that it won't be long before or as many as 30,000 fans could be inside stadiums. So you could get a situation where Barcelona could potentially get the Nou Camp a third full, and Real Madrid are playing in front of 1,500 people at their training ground. So a potential error there from Real Madrid to get the Bernabeu redeveloped and sort of take advantage, if you like, of that time. I would also edge just towards Barcelona. They've got the greater goal scorers, you know, with Griezmann, Messi and Luis Suarez. It's been a problem for Real Madrid for much of the season.
You mentioned that there, a problem for Real Madrid. It's a problem that's going to have to be fixed very quickly, though. And who do you think is going to step up and start scoring goals for them?
Well, I think the one that they'll be hoping for is Eden Hazard, who has done next to nothing really in a Real Madrid shirt. Of course, he was the huge signing last summer. People were expecting him to just kind of roll out his Chelsea form. He admitted that he didn't arrive in Madrid in the best of shape. He had I suppose a relaxed summer might be one way of putting it. And he was a little bit overweight, and not the best way to approach joining a new club. If Real Madrid can get Hazard, you know, fit, firing and playing to the level that we all know that he can for Belgium and Chelsea previously, then he is the chief creator. Maybe won't get the amount of goals that Barcelona get, you know, through Messi, Suarez and Griezmann, but he can create enough for the others. So that's the big hope as far as Real Madrid are concerned. I'm not ultra convinced by Karim Benzema as that number nine. I think he does a really good sort of job in terms of being the focal point of the team. Just when you look at his numbers next to, say, Messi, it just doesn't stack up.
Mark, when you look at the Bundesliga, do you think Barcelona will be actually pretty happy that these games are going behind closed doors, because their away form has been poor, dropping points on 11 occasions?
Yeah, I suppose that there would be a case for that. We don't know, whether home advantage, which appears, albeit from a very small sample size, to have disappeared in the Bundesliga, whether that will be the same in Spain, or whether there will still remain some kind of advantage to playing at home. I think whatever happens, Barcelona need to sort out this away form. It's cost them in Europe, it's cost them domestically as well. There doesn't appear to be any reason for it, so the logic in me is thinking, well, you know, they've just got better players than most of the other teams, so eventually that will just drop, and you know, they'll start getting the wins away from home. But it was definitely an issue before the lockdown, there's no doubt about it.
Turning our attention to the Premier League and specifically the Merseyside Derby. It is going to be played at Goodison Park and all going to plan. The plan is that Man City lose to Arsenal, then Liverpool could win the league in Merseyside.
Yeah, I'm sure that that will be the nightmare scenario for Everton supporters. I'm a Spurs fan, and we've had Arsenal, I think, on two occasions actually win the league at White Hart Lane. It's not a nice feeling. I can assure you of that. I'm pleased the game is going ahead on Merseyside. I think now just got to trust the fans to, you know, to behave themselves. In Germany, they have done. They've been in strong dialogue and constant dialogue between club and fan bases to make sure that, you know, they're well behaved in terms of, you know, not causing disruption outside the stadium. You know, the Premier League are trusting in the supporters. Now it's time for the supporters to, you know, to do their bit too.
That hasn't been the case though in the Portuguese league. You look at the Benfica bus, two players getting injured in it. Is there a call that some big games could be better in a venue that is outside the big cities?
I mean, you can sort of, I suppose you can make, that case, you can sort of argue it, but I just don't like the idea of neutral venues, particularly when for sort of much of the season has been played with, you know, some kind of home advantage. And I think it's just about, it is about trusting the general public. I know, you know, not everybody wants to do that, and it can be difficult at times. But I would prefer until we get to a situation where you know, if they misbehave, then you have to move it for the next game. But I think you have to trust them in the first instance.
Fans are going to travel anyway, I think, Mark, and at least if they're in their own city, they can go home.
Yeah, there is that. I mean, what would stop, I mean, we'll use Liverpool as an example. What would stop Liverpool fans? You know, there was talk of that game being played at St Mary's. I mean, you know, you just, if you wanted to, if you're that desperate to, you know, to be at the venue, you're absolutely spot on. They just drive to Southampton, and, you know, Liverpool fans are dotted all over the world anyway. So, you know, it's not, I don't really buy that argument that it would completely stop it anyway. I think that is correct.
Mark. That's a complete Irish response by Marie. Just see the guards and the police saying, lads, go home, enough of it. Thanks so much for joining us on Game On. We look forward to catching up as everything kicks off around Europe. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Game On 2FM.